That's right.
And this so-called town, it looks like a rubbish pit from the mines. Old machinery, rubbish just dumped there, and a bit of a cesspool. And just a barbed wire around. That was, and this whole, that was the camp. Anyhow, they had nothing to do all day, just sit on this rubbish heap. There was no water to drink, only this dirty cesspool. And when midday came, they came with our food, and it was about 15 grains of sorghum, which is a very coarse grass seed. And it's a bit like a husk on it. So we just fed it quick because we were starving. But we found out it was a waste of time because as we ate it, that's how we passed it. So the next day when it came, we got the thing, we spent most of the time taking the husk on before we ate it. Now, the meanwhile, the first thing we discussed about this officer came back. Somebody said, well, I don't want to go and fight for peace. You know, we said, well, it's either fight for peace, as they say, but we use that as an excuse. Oh, you're dying here. There's no way of surviving this place. So we all agreed that if he came back, we'd all go to this camp. So anyhow, he did come back, and he lined us all up, and he spoke to us all, and we all agreed that we'd go to this camp. He said, very well. So he lined us all up and picked 8 of us and said, okay, you go 8 go over there, you're the 5, you stay in the camp. So we all moaned about them being left behind. He said, we've been together all the time. He said, I've only got room for 8. I'll come back to them. So he said, are you sure you're going to... Yeah, he said, so we get room, a couple of days, I'll come back. So away we went, saying to them, practically crying because we knew if he didn't come back, that would be the last. Away we go, we were about 5 miles, and we came down these hills, we came to this river, and there's a rowboat waiting for us there, a big rowboat. With a British bloke in it. And he was from this camp and he rowed us across the river, you know, in relay, because the boat couldn't carry us at all. And we got to this camp, and what it wasn't a camp as people think. It was a little school complex in a village, on the side of the village, on the riverside of the village. And when we arrived there, there must have been about 50 prisoners there. Some British, but mostly American sergeants and officers. And when we got there, they asked us who we were and that. And they cut our hair with cut all our hair off, and they shaved us. And how they shaved us was, the first of all, they cut off the scissors, and they had a razor which had been made out of a hacksaw blade. What they did is where the teeth were, they broke it as the length they wanted, and where the teeth were, they hammered metal onto it to make it thick. And they put out, while all this happened, suddenly got 2 stones rubbed up together with water until they were flat, and then sharpened the hacksaw blade until it was as sharp as a razor. And that's how they shaved us. They had a little bit of soap, which we turned out the only soap there available was for shaving. So this bloke by the name of Sid Carr, he was the only one allowed to shave. So he used to shave you. It's a bit strange, but it was lovely that it was finished. And then after that, we went down the river, stripped all our clothes off, and bathed down there. There was no soap. What we used was the sand as a soap, and get all the grit and dead skin off from that. And then when we came back, we were trying to put the clothes back, I had to come back nude. And they issued me with cotton underpants, cotton vest, cotton shirt, cotton trousers, and a hat. That was our clothing. They had no socks or footwear, so you had to wash your socks, what was left of them, and put on your old boots. And that was more or less the routine. And what we did, and our old clothes, we had to be in the camp, they were covered in mice and what have you. So the routine at home of the camp was, we got 3 meals a day, was a small bowl of rice and a watery soup. It was that had a marrow in it, which was, it was that little marrow, you could just barely see it, or dandelion leaves, or something like that. And you got that 3 times a day. in the morning, after between meals, he'd go to this hall and he'd be lectured on the communist and what have you, and also in the afternoon. And in the evening, you had free time, plus you have discussions about different things there when you're sitting down. And sometimes they'll ask you to write letters to send to newspapers and all that. So we said to one of the officers, we don't like doing this. He said, you just write letters in your own words. We'll see that your letters don't get passed. There's a couple of us who have been agreed that any letters to be passed will come from the high officers. So if there's any explain to do, they will explain when they get home. But any letters you write, we'll see that it doesn't get passed. Good feeling. Anyhow, that was more of the routine all the time. The other things outstanding during that time there was we were attacked a few times by American airplanes. It was usually on the return run. And one of the Americans explained to us what he was doing was emptying his guns before he lands. On one particular occasion, we were all down, we were carrying stuff up from the beach. And so there was a line from the beach all the way to our complex. And I didn't work because I couldn't work because I had any stomach. And this was plane came over and machine gun from our village complex right down to the river. During that time, it didn't hit anybody. But there was a group of six of us in our village by the cookhouse. So when he came across the machine gun, we dived into the cookhouse, into the well. And when we got out, there was a bloke by the name of Lyons. He was still down on the floor. So he said, oh, he must knock his head get when he got fell down. So anyhow, we picked him up and we revived him. And it was later we found out he had a heart attack when it happened. And after that, we went into the hut. We had two huts where we slept in. When we went in there, there was one bloke asleep with his legs apart on the floor. There was a trail of machine gun bullets all the way across the floor. And these legs were in the gap between the hit of the bullets. And they hadn't been touched. We didn't even know about it. But another time, in the late summer, it started raining. And the rain was that heavy, we could actually jump in and out of the rain. And it was absolutely black. And the bubbles went out the ground, and this went on for days and days. And during that time, the river, which is about a half a mile slope all the way down, started rising. And there was houses floating down, pigs, animals, all trees that were floating down the river. And eventually, the river came up to where we were, and it was flooding us out. So we moved up to this hall where we used to do our lecturing, which was higher ground. We stayed there the night. And he said, if it doesn't rain, stop raining before the morning, we'll have to go up in the mountains because this river will flood. Now, luckily, it stopped and the river started receding. And the river started to clear all the mess up. I forgot to mention that during a long walk, Sergeant Hooper, who was with us, wants to make a note of all the names in case anything happened to us and any particular thing that happened. He wanted somebody with any paper. Nobody had any paper. So he said, oh, have I George's Bible? So he asked me for his Bible. I said, I don't like parting with this. He said, I'm only borrowing it. He said, to write all the particulars down, the names and all like that. I said, all right, well, I want it back. He said, as soon as you get to a place where I can copy all this, I'll give you it back. But as I say, when the time came to give me back, he was fit with me before I had a chance asking for it or him to give it to me, and I've never seen him again. I've never seen me Bible again, but I believe it's in England somewhere. Anyway, as winter approached, you had the Peace Corps talks going on, and during the Peace Corps talks, the reporters and the correspondents from the Eastern Bloc countries used to pass through Kirkby to go to Panmunjom. And this time we're told we're having the correspondents come to this camp to see how well we're looked after. So anyhow, we all spruced the camp up and all that as you usually do. and they laid out food in it, on tables and all that, and they had paper tablecloths, and on the tables you had 2 rounds of bread, a bottle of wine or whatever it was, an apple, and all the odds and ends. And then when the correspondent came up, they took all the windows out of this room, and that was actually, it was the room we slept in, and we filmed, we used to have 2 sittings, so they filmed the first sitting, eating their food and everything, and all that. So when he'd all finished eating, we queued up to go in, and he said, no, wait until the reporters have gone, and we'll do it then. So all the reporters went, and all that. We went in for our meal, and what we got was a little bowl of rice, and our water was soup again. So we were disappointed. And I said, already afterwards, I came out to one of my mates and said, oh, you lucky devil, getting all that food, all we had that. I said, you could have saved me a round of bread. He said, I saved a round. So we made a round, we toasted it, and we had half a round each. Anyhow, as the winter approached, we went down and got wood, and they made in the big room that we slept in, they made bunk beds, one bunk the full length of the room, two tiers, and they had a gap of about 4 foot on one end, and in the middle you put a boiler there where you burn coal dust, so there's a mine nearby full of coal dust, so you used to go down there and then and get coal dust and keep the place warm. We were issued with no winter clothing. I didn't like that. We just had the summer clothing all the time. And we had no socks for that, so the white felt jacket that I've got earlier on, which I washed and kept clean, somebody made a pattern for making socks. So we made socks, as many pairs of socks we could have, this white jacket. So I had a pair and other people had a pair. And then, when it began in December, he lined us all up and said, the war is nearly over. You are going to be sent home via Shanghai. You're going to go, the Chinese are going to pick you up, take you to a camp on the Yalu. From there, they're going to take you by train all the way to Shanghai. They're going to put you on the ship and send you home. So the next day, the issue was with winter clothing. No boots, no footwear, no socks, just a padded trousers and padded jacket and a padded hat. It's similar to what the soldiers were, or the police were. And our trucks came down to us and took us north, and we travelled about 2 days by truck. Eventually we arrived in the evening when it was dark, and all the officers and all the sergeants and above were split from us without any knowledge, they were all calling in, you, because we didn't know what was happening. So we were all put in this big room, hut, with a number of rooms in, and we saw the first exigency since we were captured. And it was very dim light, and we were trying to find out what was going on. And he brought us some food, which was plenty of rice, a big bowl of soup with veg and meat and all that in it. And what we call the Chinese wedding cake, another bowl, which is if the outside rice has been gone crispy with the cooking it. So we had a good feed of that. And then some lads came up from the other part of the camp, see who we were, and one lad said, any scouts here? He said, yeah. He said, come down to our room after, he told me where it was. He said, I got a bit of bread there, a bit of dripping, we had a dripping butter. And now we were telling them that we were going home. But it turned out we weren't. It was a big ploy by the Chinese. They got all the United Nations prisoners off the Koreans, because if the time come for release, there would be no fixed state to be released. It would be a bad thing, you know, for their image. So their idea was to get us into their camp. They couldn't ask the Koreans for us to be able to give them. But they used the war being over to get those off the Chinese, off the Koreans. And now we spent the next, I'm seeing 18 months there, getting fed up, so we could be in a reasonable condition to be released. And during that, after a day there, all the lads who'd been in our camp had all got the diarrhoea, and they were eating this rich food, because we hadn't eaten any meat like that for 8 months, and we had lots of trouble, you know, eating. Our tongues were red raw, we had scars on both sides of our cheek, where the acid had come off on my tongue and put out your lips and burnt your cheek. Your tongues are red raw. We even got sugar ration given to us, like 2 tablespoons for a month. And we went to be dazzled just by eating glass. Anyhow, we improved as we got used to the food. I got frostbite in my feet, I had loads of trouble with my legs, pains and that. And the Chinese, as we thought, sick to Chinese with it. I used to try all kinds to do something with it. They give me acupuncture for about a month, every day, stay every month, and made no difference. So I don't know what the devil was on.
What was the name of this camp?
Camp 5. Oh, the Korean camp was Camp 12. The so-called camp, as in before, like a rubbish tip, that was known as Camp 9, or the caves. Because when the weather got bad, they moved from this open area, you know, into the actual caves themselves, where it was the mine shafts. Well, this was a Chinese camp, Camp 12, which was located right on the Yellow River. From where we were, we could see across into China. And they couldn't fight, they couldn't do anything with me, like with my legs, pains on my legs. Anyhow, the camp wasn't a home from home, but was a lot better than I had before. Like, at least we were getting decent food. We could write letters home and get the letters back. And up to arrive at that camp, I wasn't a prisoner of war. I wasn't anybody. Because the North Koreans could have done anything they wanted with us. They had no questions, nobody to answer to, because as far as they were concerned, I was dead. Nobody knew where I was or nothing. And not only me, the others. And it wasn't until I actually got in the Chinese that I was reported to England that I was a prisoner of war. And my mother didn't find out till Boxing Day, 1951. And it was the cooperative society that notified her that I was a prisoner of war. And when 1953 came along, we were talking about me patrolling sick and wounded. And there was a number of our lads in our camp were picked out for the various reasons to be sent home with sick and wounded. And I was released in April 1953. And what happened when we were getting released? We were taken out of the camp. And as our camp was the main HQ for the camps, we were put in tents just outside the camp, and the other sick and wounded from other camps came and joined us. We were issued with all new clothing, and we got, by this time, we got an overcoat as well, and we were treated to a barbecue, in our barbecue, a special treat with eggs and all that. And then they gave us, they asked us, has everything been taken off us while we're prisoner of war? Which we told them that we'd had our, either the light had not taken, which they replaced. And then they told us to tell the people how good we looked after them and that. And then we were sent by truck to Panmunjom, the open back truck. And it took us 3 or 4 days, I can't remember how, we were counting the days then. We ran right across the mountain ranges, and we were escorted by 4 American fighters. And these fighters were specially painted. So all the fighters knew who they were, the Koreans knew who they were, and their job was to keep any fighter, American or Russian, away from our convoy. And every so often they'd be getting swapped over and leave as the fuel getting low. And as we were going out, all the villagers were cheering us. And when we got near Pyongyang, it was that badly damaged, nowhere to live. The people were living in the ground at the side of the road, dug out into the ground. And eventually we got near Panmunjom. And we stopped, and the night beforehand, they gave us a good cleaning up. And and then they put us in their type of buses. Not buses, coaches today. Bus coaches. And he drove us into Panmunjom. And it gave the impression to the people there that we'd all come away from the prison camps and these vehicles were actually coming out and back vehicles. And then we were handed over to our own people, and Americans, and there we were interviewed and photographed back and issued new clothing and sent telegraphs home. And then we spent the night in the American hospital there, didn't do any treatment, just asked questions, see how you were and all that. And the next day we were flown to Curie by Dakota, then trained into the hospital. And we stayed there a few days while they checked us all out and got messages from home and all that paper. And then we got issued with new gear, and then we flew out home by the Hastings. We'd done it in leapfrogging, staying overnight at each one. We first went to Clarkfield in the Philippines, then we went to Singapore, then Colombo, then a place in Iran or Iraq, I can't remember, then Malta, then we flew home to Lyon Airfield, where our Mexican was meeting us. And then we were sent to a big military hospital there for a quick check over and all our papers. And then I met my mother in Houston, Victoria Station, and we came home.
Was there any attempt whilst you were a POW to turn you into a communist?
Yeah, that was all at the peace camp. And when we first went to the Chinese. But we learned that if anybody was stubborn and didn't want to learn communism or anything like that, they would keep on at them until they did turn colours. Now, if you had disagreed with them, and then, as they spoke to you, gradually disagreed on your terms, after a while, they think you've been converted. And all the time, people are there like, you know what you're doing, and they will stop forcing you. You give the right answers when they want them, act the same way where they want them. But as soon as they're out of sight, you're back to normal. You're going to play them at their own game. That's what we learned. But they get some people, oh, I'm not going to do this, I'm not going to do that. They keep arm at them and arm at them until they do it. Instead of getting rid of their own free will, they get brainwashed. A man only gets brainwashed who is stubborn. If you play their game, you can't get brainwashed.
What opinion of the Chinese and North Koreans did your experience in Korea leave you with?
Well, the experience about the North Koreans. Now, the Korean cities, they looked at it that we were in the same boat. I mean, as prisoners of war, we were in the same boat as them, but they couldn't do anything about it. So whenever they could help you without getting into trouble, they would do. Now, the police and the soldiers, they had authority, and they had the upper hand, and they knew it, and they would use it. And I think the reason they have that attitude is they've been dominated for so many years by other powers that they think that's the right way of doing it. Plus, so constantly, they're getting their own back for what's been done to them for so many years. Now, with regards to the Chinese, I find that the majority of Chinese, if they're being indoctrinated, they're all for communism. They didn't like the Americans, but they didn't have a wrong word to say about the British. I even met Chinese who would tell me all about my hometown, Liverpool, about the pubs there and all that. And when I asked them, how come you know so much about my town, Liverpool, and the pubs and this and that? Paul, he said, we were on ships with the Royal Navy during the war, and we used to call in Liverpool. We got friends and relations living in Liverpool, and that's how they knew it. But the majority of the Chinese, they were very, very good. I mean, if they saw the Koreans taking advantage of you, they would shoot the Koreans before they let them get away with it. Because I heard tales of one of them in the front line and a prisoner of war being taken, and a Korean has gone to shoot him, and a Chinese turned around and shot the Korean before he has a chance to shoot the prisoner of war. There was no loss between the North Koreans and the Chinese. And I got the opinion, this is my own personal opinion, that the Chinese came into the war not to defend North Korea. They thought America was going to attack China. They thought that was it. That's what they thought. And that, and before they had a chance of actually doing it, they went into the aid of North Korea. But I don't know how true that. That's the impression I got from the Chinese.
Which company and platoon were you in? Can you remember?
Yep, I was in 8th Platoon, C Company.
Now, maybe if we can just go back to your earlier life in Liverpool, I think you can remember the Liverpool Blitz. What do you remember about that?
Well, Liverpool Blitz, what I remember, I lived just on the outskirts of Liverpool, like in Liverpool, but on the outer side of Liverpool, which is about 5 miles of coastline from the airfield bay ahead. And we saw all the bombing of the city itself. What's called it, you know, like in the sky and here. Now, but regard to where I actually live, we had loads of incendiary bombs dropped, and we had a couple of oil bombs dropped, and right at the back of our house, where the hospital is, there was four unexploded bombs dropped from this hospital, which is waste ground, and one dropped on the sanatorium and brought half of that down, and we had a landmine which landed. It was actually, we were looking at the shelter and we saw this parachute coming down, and we said, look, what's that? No man on it, it's a big square box or something, and it was just about to come down, and a gust of wind came, and it just went up and drifted again. And now this bit of on to from our house, this railway line that runs in an embankment, and it turned out this it was a landmine, and it actually landed in the embankment. And it ended up on the side of the embankment nearest to our house. And when it went off, most of the blast went away from our house and blew down at the houses there. And we only heard the sound of the going off. And so we were lucky that gust of wind came and blew it away from there, our house. I remember another time on that particular time, the main blitz, the blitz was that bad. There was no trams running, all tram lines and overhead cables were off. And I had to go to the clinic, the school clinic. It was about 4 miles away. I had to walk all the way there, right through all the rubble. Luckily, the clinic was still open. And I got the ice seen to. You had no people coming around the school, then you had to go to the clinic. And then I have to walk all the way back. I mean, a child nowadays would never think of doing that. I started work in 1941. I got a job actually in the town. And just by where I worked, in the centre, in Paradise Street, Church Street, Lord Street, that was actually the centre. All the buildings